From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. We'll have our famous open lines a little bit later on tonight. Let me bring you up to speed on some of the stories of the day, and then we'll bring in Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. What an incredible story when I saw this. A secretive encounter with a Bedouin in a desert valley led to the discovery of two fragments from a nearly 2,000-year-old parchment scroll, the first such finding in decades, according to archaeologists in Israel. The finding has given rise to hope that the Judean desert may yield more treasures. The two small pieces of brown animal skin inscribed in Hebrew with verses from the book of Leviticus are from the refugee camps in caverns, a canyon near the Dead Sea, where Jews hid from Romans in the 2nd century. The scrolls are being tested by Israel's Antiquities Authority, and recently several relics bearing inscriptions, including a burial box purported to belong to Jesus' brother James, were revealed as modern forgeries. Now, more than 1,000 ancient texts, known collectively as the Dead Sea Scrolls, were discovered between 1947 and 1956 in 11 caves overlooking the western shores of the Dead Sea. With this find, they think maybe there might be more writings and scriptures hidden away in caves. So they're going to go back and start looking. A man suspected of being the bomb maker in last week's London terror attacks has been apprehended in Cairo. I'm not going to give you his name. It's longer than my arm. But he has denied any role in the attacks. He's 33 years old, a chemist, a former North Carolina State University graduate student. He had been sought as the possible bomb maker in the London attacks, which killed 54, wounded more than 700. In Iraq, car bombs, explosions rocked wide areas of the Iraqi capital, targeting U.S. and Iraqi security forces, killing at least 29 people. Two U.S. Marines died in a blast near the Jordanian border. At least 111 people, including 7 American soldiers, were wounded in the bombings. At least 7 of them were homicide attacks. In Orlando, Florida, the addition of finger scanning technology at the entrances of Walt Disney World theme parks for all visitors has caused concern among some privacy advocates. Tourists visiting Disney theme parks in Central Florida must now provide their index and middle fingers to be scanned before entering the front gates. The scans were formerly for season pass holders, but now everyone must provide their fingers. They have reportedly been phased in for all ticket holders now during the past 6 months. Disney officials said the scans help keep track of who is using legitimate tickets. Critics of the new scanning technology do not agree with Disney, and they say the scans border on a violation of privacy. They say it's a step in the wrong direction, according to a spokesperson for the American Civil Liberties Union. NASA says it would not try to launch the space shuttle Discovery until late next week now. At the earliest, the space agency is backing out of the countdown and has given up trying to launch attempt anytime soon until they figure out exactly what is wrong with one of four hydrogen fuel gauges. The external fuel gauges in the tank malfunctioned during a routine pre-launch test on Wednesday. In British Columbia, the Canadian Coast Guard rescued a woman who floated 9 miles across the Georgia Strait after falling off a sailboat near Vancouver. Rescuers said the 40-year-old woman was believed to have spent about 9 hours in the water without a life jacket, but was conscious when she was found by another boat. She was treated for hypothermia. Listen to this story out of Germany. There was a couple that rented an apartment on the ground floor. They call them flats there, as they do here sometimes. Well, the dog, their pet, regularly jumped out from the window of his owner's ground floor flat. Except this time they moved to the 6th floor and never told the dog. They kept the window open. The dog, though, jumps out the window. He's saved because he lands miraculously on a neighbor's balcony 3 floors below. Well, they call their fire department out there. They came and rescued the dog because they couldn't get down to get him. The people who were in the apartment three floors below weren't home. So the dog is down there yelping, and they saved him. But they're going to have to teach him or close those windows, or he's going to keep jumping again. Well, tonight is it. This is the deadline. It's all over now for Prophet Yahweh, who claims that he can summon UFOs. As of 10 minutes ago, nothing has happened. The deadline officially is 11:59 p.m. Pacific time, an hour and 47 minutes. However, there is a big UFO story. It has to do with something that happened in Idaho not too long ago. In a moment, Peter Davenport, the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, and three witnesses about this incredible story. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Peter Davenport is the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. He was the founding president of a Seattle-based biotechnology company, which currently employs more than 300 scientists and technicians. Peter has had an active interest in the UFO phenomenon from his early boyhood. He experienced his first UFO sighting in my hometown of St. Louis's Municipal Airport. It's now called Lambert Field, in the summer of 1954, and he investigated his first UFO case during the summer of 1965 in Exeter, New Hampshire. Peter has been witness to several anomalous events, possibly UFO-related, including a dramatic sighting over Baja California in 1990 and several nighttime sightings over Washington State in 1992. In addition to being the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter has served as the director of investigations for the Washington chapter of the Mutual UFO Network. Peter brings with us tonight an incredible story, and in a moment we'll also introduce three witnesses to this incredible story as well. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you, George. It's nice to be back. It's always fun to be on this program. It's a high honor to be here tonight.
I tell you what, Peter, these UFO reports just continue to come in, don't they?
They do indeed, and people are constantly saying, or they're asking, I should say, are the UFO reports on the increase, or are they diminishing in number, or what? I usually parry those questions because it's very difficult to know the answer to that question, trying to separate whether the reports are multiple reports of the same event, and there are just many problems in trying to answer that question. But of late, we have been getting a lot, many reports, much more so than in the past, and they're becoming, from my vantage point, they're becoming more and more convoluted, more and more dramatic, George. And tonight's witnesses, I think, will underscore that statement.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit, before we bring the witnesses in, Peter, exactly what this case is, how it came to your attention at the National UFO Reporting Center.
Yeah. Well, a week ago this morning, that makes it Friday, the 8th of July, year 2005, I got a call from two very serious-sounding people over near Boise, Idaho. Boise is in the western part of the state of Idaho. It's just across the border from Oregon. And these people were describing a sighting that they had had earlier in the morning. It was about 5 minutes past midnight on Friday morning. That is Idaho time. And the more I listened to their story, the more intrigued I became. And I encouraged them to submit brief written reports to give us a first good glimpse into what had happened during this alleged event. And the more I learned about it, and the more I talked with the witnesses, and the more they reported to me what they were experiencing and what they were beginning to remember about the event earlier that morning, the more interesting it became. And I am delighted to not only to have an opportunity to be able to present this case to a large body of people, to the Coast listeners, but delighted that our witnesses were able to appear on this program tonight, and we're willing to do so because they've been through a lot over the last week. So that, in a nutshell, is what happened from my vantage point. What they report happened to them is they were driving on a semi-rural road out west of Boise in the town of Meridian, Idaho, again at 5 minutes past midnight, and the attention of two of them, the two adults in the car, two children were asleep in the back seat, their attention was immediately drawn to the left side of the vehicle as they drove east into Meridian and Boise. And almost as quickly as I can say it, an object streaked across the top of their car, or maybe a little bit ahead of it, and they watched it appear to descend towards a nearby field off to their right. Well, that was the beginning of the event, the beginning of their awareness of what had taken place during that time. And we now have some interesting objective information to the effect that there may be missing time. The two witnesses to this object have some peculiar pains, one with a very interesting wound on his foot. And that is just a prelude to what happened, George, just a thumbnail sketch of what these three very interesting witnesses are going to be sharing with the Coast audience tonight. It's a fascinating report.
Peter, you have sent us two images, which we've posted on the Coast to Coast AM website.
Yeah.
And image number one includes the peculiar wound you just mentioned on the left foot of a witness.
Correct.
It looks like a burn mark to me.
Yes.
As I look at this picture.
Yes. It does to me, too. And that was what the witness reported it appeared to look like to him. He was flummoxed by it. He had no idea where it had come from. And we're also going to hear that young man's mother on the program tonight. She's the third person who is a registered nurse and who looked at that wound the morning that her son discovered it. And we can ask her appraisal of that wound. She says it's very unusual, and it surprised her as well. So we have a very dramatic case here, George, and it's currently under investigation by the Idaho chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. I've turned it over to Mr. Robert Gates, who is the state director. He's interviewed the parties involved over the telephone, and he hopes to have a witness on the ground here, or rather an investigator, I should say, on the ground in the very near future.
Peter, do you know, with regards to this specific case, if there were other witnesses or people who phoned either MUFON or the National UFO Reporting Center or police departments?
Yeah, I don't, George, in a word. That's always the thing that a serious investigator looks for, since we know from experience, from decades of experience, that out of 1,000 people who have seen a bona fide, genuine UFO, only one or at most a handful of people will step forward and report it. So one of the major tricks that a UFO investigator is confronted with or should be engaging in is trying to find those other witnesses who hopefully will serve as provide corroborative testimony and hopefully independent corroborative testimony in the sense that they may not know about the other people who have reported the same or a similar event.
Peter, you have run the National UFO Reporting Center for a number of years now. You fund it out of your own pocket. And we'll talk a little bit more about what you do next hour when we take phone calls from our Coast listeners. But in all your career of investigating UFOs, how would you categorize the last few years, including 2005, with UFO reports? Are they better reports, poor reports? What would you categorize them as?
Well, I think we're getting more reports, that's for sure. And some of those reports are of extremely high quality. Reports from airline pilots, reports from police officers, professionals of all stripes, physicians, astronomers even. On that latter point, let me say that there is a mistaken impression among, particularly among members of academia and the astronomy community that astronomers do not see and report UFOs. Nothing could be further from the truth, from my vantage point. So we continue to get those high-quality reports, largely thanks to programs like this, George, where literally millions of people become aware of the National UFO Reporting Center, in some cases or many cases for the first time. They know that there's a facility where they can report a sighting of something unusual, where the information is going to be preserved and properly used, where their anonymity will be guaranteed, and so on and so forth. One of the things, however, that is happening at the other end of the stick here is that we're getting many, many hoaxed calls, hoaxed reports, I think largely because of that added notoriety, again, thanks to programs like this, but also because so many young people now have cell phones.
Yes.
And those cell phones are causing us real headaches, and maybe we can talk about this during the second hour tonight, because I'm not sure that parents are supervising their children properly and what their children are doing with those cell phones. It is now the case, I'm saddened to have to report, George, that I estimate about a third or a half of the reports that come into the center are now clearly hoaxed reports with young people, oftentimes teenagers, screaming obscenities and all sorts of filth into the telephone and then hanging up. I cannot tell you how frustrating this is.
Peter, I have a source whose name will be known to you later that I will mention him in a I would hope a few months I'll be able to do this, and I'd like to bring you in on this when we do this.
Okay.
But apparently he has, and I have no reasons to doubt this person because he's very close to some things that I have done in the past and some things I'm doing in the future. He has 20 governmental witnesses who have not appeared before with, let's say, Stephen Greer's very fine disclosure project. These are people who have decided to come forward. Some of them will protect their identity, some may not, but they have decided that enough is enough, and they want to come forward in a very credible fashion, and they want to splash it in a very big way, hence our show. And they want to come forward in the next couple months, I'm told, and tell the world about what they know, what the government knows, what the government's been hiding about this UFO case all around this planet over the years. And
that's a very exciting development, George, and I look forward to that because I know that there are many serious-minded people out there who have had, in some cases, personal experience with the UFO phenomenon through official channels, and they've also seen what they construe to have been UFOs. So this is a very interesting development, and I look forward to that with eager anticipation. I would like to see an end put to this debate over whether UFOs are real or not. Frankly, it would allow me to take a vacation.
You take a vacation?
And cut the telephone line. I'm looking forward to that, believe me.
We don't want you to cut that phone line, Peter, except that it does cost you some money. And, you know, one of the things, and I know, Peter, the hair on his arms goes up every time I ask you to send in a few dollars to the National UFO Reporting Center, but I think it's my obligation to, because he won't. Anything you can spare, $5, $25. I have an address for you, and also his website is ufocenter.com, ufocenter.com. And there's an address, of course, the National UFO Reporting Center. It's P.O. Box 45623, 45623. It's University Station, Seattle, Washington, 98145, 98145. Peter, I know how much you cringe every time I want to do this for you, but somebody's got to do it because you have been very important to this program and some other national shows that broadcast UFO issues, and without you, we lose a tremendous source, and I don't want to see that happen.
Well, thank you for doing that, George. I'm indebted to you. And yes, it's not something that I find easy to talk about. I'd rather talk about UFOs when we have a large audience. But those minor donations are a big help in paying the $500 to $1,000 a month it costs me roughly to run this center. So I'm very grateful to you.
We'll be back in a moment with the three witnesses that Peter Davenport has brought us. And I'm telling you, this is an incredible story. And the next hour, Peter will stick around and take your phone calls about UFOs and some very new things that might be happening in that arena. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this has been the first week that we're giving away this free CD, Perfect Possession, Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin, a brand new one. And it is going like crazy. A couple ways you can get this free CD. Well, you get an After Dark subscription. That's it. You call 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com, get the CD, Perfect Possession, when you get an After Dark newsletter subscription. Peter, I'm going to have you introduce our three witnesses, but right during the break, some breaking news came into you.
Yeah, it did indeed, and we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
It's a very interesting report. Well, I apologize to our witnesses for having them stand by for a little bit here, but I'm sure it won't diminish the dramatic nature of their story a bit. We have three people standing by in the Boise, Idaho area, and I don't think we've agreed on pseudonyms yet, but I think the names that they'd like to use are Alma, Jay, and Esther.
Okay.
And why don't we bring at least Alma on?
They're all there now, waiting, sharing the same lines.
They're on the same. Okay, good. Well, why don't we invite Alma to kick this off and just give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened just about a week ago, Friday morning, the 8th of July, as they drove down a rural road near Boise, Idaho.
Very good.
Good evening, Alma.
Good evening.
Hi, Alma. And Alma, you are Jay's aunt, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. And as Peter was saying, tell us a little bit about what happened.
We were driving into Meridian on Cherry Lane Road, and we were discussing 911 and the bombing in London, and we were just enjoying the ride. My nephew was going around 45. My grandchildren were sleeping in the back. I had bought a car from him, so I was letting him drive it back to Meridian from Fruitland, Idaho, where I live. And all of a sudden, a bright, bright light come upon us, and Jay said, "What the heck?" He said, like, it's the UFO. And then at the same time, I turned, and I was blinded by this bright light, and I, oh, it's going to land on us. But at the same time, I turned to my nephew, and I could just see the light was so bright that I could just see his shadow. But all this was going in seconds, and I had my grandchildren asleep in the back seat. You know, they're my whole life, mm-hmm. And so I was concerned about their safety. And then I quickly turned in a second in front of me, and I seen something like a disc or a big frisbee just for a second, and then the light was kind of like a healing light upon me, and I at that time I feel that my power was so strong for the safety of my grandchildren that it just seemed to have beamed away. I turned because I was on the passenger side. And then I said, "Jay, that plane is going to crash. This run is just so low." Then it was dark, and then it disappeared. Then I seen a flashing blue light. And then I just, I seemed like I was dazed. I said, "What time is it?" He said, "It's 12:05. Then at the time, it was like a matter of like 15 seconds or less.
Mm-hmm.
I I said, well, move it, move it. I feel like I put the children in danger. And I said, well, where did it go? And I was looking up, and there was nothing. It was dark, dark, dark.
Did it have any sound, Elma?
Pardon?
Did it have any sound to it?
There was more like a humming sound. It was smooth. I was mostly, like I said, in a daze.
Yeah.
Mostly concerned for my grandchildren. And then I said, you know, Dave, we didn't have the children. We could pull over and see where it went. But I said, let's move on and go.
Yeah,
he was driving about 45. And it was what I was going to explain about this beam on me, it was so like a spiritual healing, peaceful. I wasn't afraid for me, but it was for my grandchildren.
Was it like they were trying to communicate with you, Alma, through beam?
I felt that my power was so strong for their safety. That was all I was concerned about, you know. That it was just almost hitting me. It was like a golden light, but like I said, everything went in seconds. And then it just zoomed away. And I suddenly felt like I had been on a nap, and I said, what time is it? He said, it's 12:05.
All right.
And then I couldn't find it. And the children, I glanced, they were still sleeping, and you know, it was really...
It was something, I'm sure. Hey, Peter, with that, let's bring Jay in, all right?
Are you with us, Jay?
Yeah, hello.
Oh, thank you for coming on the line tonight. I can't thank you enough, and my gratitude to your aunt as well for making yourselves available. And I know you've not been feeling well today, Jay, so we're particularly indebted to you.
Thank you.
Tell us, if you would please, where you were and what happened from start to finish. What did you first see, and how did the events unfold a week ago, please?
Well, the first thing that I saw from out of nowhere were these four round bright lights that came up to the side of the car and was keeping speed with the side of the car, and it was at the same level as was where I was sitting, so it was right there in my face. And I was thinking, what the heck could that be? And it flew over the car, and there was maybe a clearance of 2 feet between us and the object. And I was going to reach up because there's a sunroof in the car, but by the time I reached up, it was already out in the field, and it was very low. Mm-hmm. And it looked like a large wing to me, but more like a saucer. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking this thing that's maybe 1 foot off the ground in the field, and I'm thinking, well, if that was a plane, it would have made some kind of a noise, because planes usually do make lot of noise. And a helicopter, I would have known if that was a helicopter, because helicopters, you can hear them.
So you don't think it was any kind of aircraft that was spraying an aerial applicator, spraying agricultural chemicals, or anything along those lines, eh?
Right, because the only thing that you could hear was just the sound of vacuum, or like Alma said, a real light humming noise.
Jay, did you ever think for a moment, we really must have some incredible technology to have some kind of a craft like this? Or did you begin to think, where in the heck did this thing come from?
Yeah, when I got home, I couldn't sleep for a couple hours because I was trying to think, well, the universe is so big that there has to be other life out there.
How did it leave? How did it disappear?
Well, I noticed that after it went down into the field, it made a flip. It flipped around to the left, and the bright white lights had gone out by this time, and a smaller blue flashing light came on, and it wobbled straight up into the sky. It wasn't a straight vertical ascent. It was more like a wobble, like a bubble would make.
Now, this wound that you have now on your left foot, a picture of which we've put up on our website, coasttocoastam.com. When did you notice that?
When I got home and I was taking my shoes and socks off, I saw the red mark on my foot. I was trying to think about where it would come from, and I can't think of where it came from at all.
And that's the only part of your body that has any kind of wound or anything like that?
Yeah. It looks a lot like a burn.
I think with that, Peter, let's bring in Esther, the mother, to Jay, okay?
Yes. Good evening, Esther.
Hello.
And thank you for coming on with us tonight. I'm delighted to have you here based on what I've learned from you just today.
Well, thank you.
And why don't you give us a little bit about your background before you go into discussion of that wound, please?
Yes. I've been a registered nurse for 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a lot of wounds and burns. And I've seen a lot of skin lesions.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first become aware of this peculiar wound on your son's foot?
The morning of Friday morning, when Justin shared the story with me, and he showed me his foot. He wanted to know what it was.
And what did you think about it?
I said, Justin, it looks like something between eczema or a burn, but it was shaped like a horseshoe, and there was no other rashes on his feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not sure what it was, because Justin always wears his socks. So I could tell it wasn't, a burn acquired from another object or something. It just was an unusual skin lesion.
And I think Peter and Esther, did they not arrive late? Esther, don't they normally get there at a certain time, or you know the distance, you know how long it takes? And this one was a little different, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very unusual. Justin called me Thursday night about 11:15 p.m. And he said he had gone to Fruitland, Idaho earlier in the day because my sister had bought his car and she had her truck. So they had to both go back to Fruitland, Idaho. And he had taken some overnight gear so he could spend the night. So when he called me 11:15 and said they had decided to come back to Meridian, I was kind of surprised. And I thought, well, why would you travel that late at night? But, you know, they said they had decided to come back, and it was 11:15. He wanted me to leave the door open and set out some bedding for my sister and her grandkids. And so I did that, and I stay up late, so it was about midnight. They hadn't arrived. So I decided to go to bed, and I said, well, they didn't come. It was silly for them to think they should travel at night like that. So I just had gone to bed and decided that they weren't going to come. So I went to bed about 12:10.
So, and Peter, let's go ahead.
Oh, and then I woke up, just because I do wake up frequently at night. I woke up about 1 o'clock, and I glanced out in the living room, and nobody was there, and I went back to bed. Then I got up closer to 2:30. And I glanced out in the living room, and they were there. And I thought, my gosh, it took them a long time to get here. Because
mm-hmm.
It should only take 45 minutes to get from my sister's house to my house. I frequently travel that route, and it's 48 miles between the two cities. And at the most, it should take, with no traffic in that time of night, at the most, it would have taken about 50 minutes.
Did they look like they were in shock, Esther?
In the morning?
Yeah.
Yes, they were very very eager to talk to me, and they said, we need to tell you something. And I said, what? And Justin showed me his foot and the burn, and they said they were really shaken up, and they had seen something in the night, and they were very concerned that they felt that their life had been put in danger by the bright light shining in the car. And I said, well, Justin, that's so dangerous. You need to report that, because somebody's shining lights in people's car when they're going 45 miles an hour. That could make you wreck. I said, regardless of what you think it is, you need to either report it to the police or to the aviation board or somebody, because somebody's either flying too low or something is not right for lights to, you know, flash it.
All right, and Jay, did you report this?
Yeah, I found a place on the website, UFO Center.
All right, so you reported it to Peter, okay.
Uh-huh.
But not to police or any other law enforcement?
Oh.
Because I would have been curious to see what kind of reaction they would have given you.
Yeah, they around here, they're really not interested in that kind of thing. They don't want to hear.
So, Peter, what do you think? Is this an abduction case? Is this just missing time? What do you think happened to these people?
Well, I'm hesitant to conjecture on that point, George, because technically speaking, an investigation has not been conducted yet, and that is yet to take place. So I think it would be inappropriate for me to make any kind of statement. But I will say that this is a particularly interesting case, particularly interesting because of the objective information that we have received from Esther with regard to the late arrival of her sister and her son. Because as she's stated here just a moment or two ago, she knows the distance between the two towns, and she's traveled that route many times before, as have both Alma and Jay, and she knows what time they should have arrived, and they didn't. And when this event occurred, they were just on the western end of Meridian. I mean, literally, if I understand things correctly, only a five-minute drive or so, at most, I guess, maybe 10 minutes from where Jay resides. The question is, why did it apparently take, so much extra time for them to get home? And that's something that has to be investigated in the course of the larger investigation of this case.
Let's ask Jay and Alma, if we can, Peter, if they think they may have been abducted. I mean, are you two having strange dreams that perhaps you think you might have been on some kind of operating table or anything like that, both of you?
No, the only thing that I experienced is some lower stomach pain and uncomfortable. I do have lower back problems, but also the second night I would close my eyes and I would see bright lights with a blue flashing light and headaches, and my eyes were still hurting from the bright lights. But I did call the police department that morning and reported it. I believe they switched me from Nampa to Cannon County, and they did say there had been no reports or they didn't of anything, but they would let us know, and then but I did mention it.
Could you see any, either you, Alma, or you, Jay, could you see any texture to this craft? I mean, did it look metallic? Did it have any grid marks to it? Did it have any signage or anything like that? Markings?
I didn't see any markings or anything. Just the shape of it in the field. And because it was so dark at night, I couldn't see a whole lot of it, just the way it was flying.
And how are you feeling now, Jay? Peter was saying you didn't feel good today. You think it has to do with this episode?
No, because I don't remember being abducted or anything like that at all.
That was some.
I remember.
Go ahead, Alma or Esther.
Oh, go ahead.
Like, I wondered, since I do have a cell phone, and why didn't I dial 911, and why did I ask, like I was in a daze? What time was almost like I was just waking up from a nap.
Yeah, it's almost like, Alma, you were hypnotized or something like that.
But look, I mentioned that the beam was so bright, but my concern, I had so much power for the safety of my grandchildren that I felt it almost draw. It was a healing, like a spiritual. And then it's like it zoomed. But the object that I did see was smooth, and it was gray silver, and there was some mist around it.
Peter, we're at the top of the hour. I want to thank your three eyewitnesses, first of all, for coming in, especially at this late hour. Jay, Alma, Esther. This case, as Peter said, is still being investigated. Something happened to these people. What? is anybody's guess right now, but hopefully the Mutual UFO Network will get to the bottom of it. Peter Davenport will stick around with us next hour. We're going to take your phone calls, perhaps your questions, and quite frankly, I want to get Peter's take on whether he thinks we've been visited in the past before, because so many recent guests are telling us these incredible theories, and I'd like to get Peter's reaction to some of this. Your calls are next as well. And then later on tonight, open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie.